Hi, this is Sun Lee, KBOO's Membership Director. I want to thank you for being a member and a listener to KBOO. I also wanted to share this listener's comment on why they support KBOO.
I started listening to KBOO's morning programming and donated for the first time over the summer. I don't tune in every day, but it dawned on me this morning that unlike other member-supported stations, I don't feel like I'm having to compromise my ethic by giving to KBOO. Thank you for the honest alternative to corporate media. Nick from Vancouver, Washington.
We hope that you feel the same. Please support your community and your local radio station by going to kboo.fm/give.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
On the KBOO Evening News, National Guard troops patrol the streets of Baltimore.
The Supreme Court hears arguments about same-sex marriage.
And are you ready for GMO mosquitoes?
KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 28th, 2015. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. Protests in Baltimore, Maryland erupted into violence yesterday over the death of Freddie Gray at the hands of police. A state of emergency has been declared. National Guard troops have been mobilized in Baltimore and a curfew from 10 p.m. until 5 a.m. has been declared. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke this morning with Major Neil Franklin, a Baltimore police officer who retired after 33 years of service, to learn more about what's going on.
We do have a state of emergency. The mayor connected with the governor yesterday evening, and they finalized it. The National Guard is on the scene here in Baltimore, along with just about every local law enforcement agency, including the Maryland State Police and surrounding counties. We're even getting some help from Governor Christie in New Jersey. So we now have sufficient numbers, at least I believe, sufficient numbers of law enforcement personnel, boots on the ground here, to help quell the uprising from yesterday, the violence and the destruction, the fires, and everything else that's going on right now. But my concern is over the next few days, especially on Friday, when the commissioner plans to announce more results of the investigation.
Neil, have you ever seen anything like this before?
Unfortunately, I have, but not during my tenure in law enforcement. It was when I was 10 years old in this very same community, the 1968 riots. It's the very community that I grew up in, and the very same streets. You know, the same buildings being involved that are involved in this were involved, you know, back in 1968. Every business, beauty salon, pharmacy, supermarket, never ever returned to that community. There's nothing but vacant lots there. And I fear that we may be seeing something else like that happen again.
The Baltimore Police Department yesterday released a memo claiming that gang members had declared a truce in order to target police officers. Later, some gang members actually released a video announcing that while they had indeed declared a truce, they were definitely not targeting anyone. What was the department thinking?
I'm not sure. I don't know what information they received or where their information came from. I don't know where their source of information came from. I can only speak to what I saw, and that was last night in an effort to quell the rioters, those who are starting the trouble. Faith leaders, men of the community, and others took to the streets, escorted by gang members who formed a truce, escorted by Bloods and Crips who were walking along with these men and women in an effort to protect them from those who were out there committing acts of violence. Now, I know these gangs, these organizations are responsible for criminal activity all across this country. I'm not defending that in any kind of way. All I'm speaking to is what they did last night and what they're doing right now in the city to demonstrate unity. If they can come together, anyone can come together.
You said that the commissioner is planning to announce results from the investigation into Freddie Gray's death sometime later this week. When is that supposed to occur?
Yes, a couple days ago he did say he gave a date of May 1st for making additional announcements regarding the results of the investigation.
One question a lot of people are asking is, why is this happening in Baltimore?
Well, people think it's from this one single event involving the death of Freddie Gray, but it's not. We're talking about decades of similar events here in Baltimore City, unfortunately at the hands of police who don't know the importance of doing things right. Or maybe they do know, they just don't care. And it's only a few of them, but it's enough to cause the problems that we see, not just here in Baltimore, but in every major city across this country. And it was only a matter of time before this thing bubbled over. And now it has. And now we're dealing with the aftermath. And until we deal with the systemic issues of what's occurring regarding the racial disparities within our criminal justice system, you know, the disparity issues we have among class in our criminal justice system, the amount of people that we imprison for nonviolent drug offenses, our drug laws that are counterproductive to public safety, as well as policies that never, ever worked unless your goal was to fill up prisons. Until we get down and start digging out the roots of these systemic issues, we will be here next year. We will be here 5 years from now and another decade from now. So I'm hoping that this literally is the moment that we had the conversations that need to be had and solve the issues and problems that we need to solve.
I've been speaking with Major Neil Franklin. He retired from the Baltimore Police Department after 33 years of service. He is currently the Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
A major action is taking place in Florida tomorrow against the GEO Group, one of the nation's largest private prison corporations and the latest incarnation of the Wackenhut Corporation. According to the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, federal prison populations increased by 50% between 2000 and 2010, while the number of federal prisoners held in private facilities almost tripled. A report published by the Huffington Post found that private prisons house nearly half of all immigrant detainees nationwide. 10 years ago, just one in four immigrant detainees were housed in private facilities. For more, KBOO's Jared Dantzler spoke with Daniel Garrillo, the executive director of Enlace, a Portland-based bilingual organization that will be participating in tomorrow's action.
You've organized an action for tomorrow. Can you tell us about this?
Yes, we're gathering, and people are flying in, like Enlace from Portland and other groups from across the country, to bring attention to what the GEO Group is doing. They're essentially tomorrow. They're going to be plotting how to increase the market of people to incarcerate and how to make more money out of that. So we're going to be gathering outside to expose what they're doing, because a lot of people haven't heard about the GEO Group or the huge lobby of the prison industry and their role in the dissemination of laws to put more people in prison.
So for those who aren't familiar, Daniel, who are the GEO Group?
So the GEO Group is an international company who builds and runs prisons and other forms of detention and prison, like electronic shackles and monitoring. And for folks in Portland, people might have heard of the prison they run in Tacoma, the Northwest Detention Center. There's been numerous lawsuits against this company for their abuse of people that they have in their prison, and also for their role in anti-immigrant laws, like the ones we saw in Arizona, SB 1070, and another federal policy that is increasing raids and detention of immigrants.
What is the connection between, say, the protests in Baltimore over police injustice, over policing, and Ferguson under the umbrella of divestment?
The connection is that, you know, corporations together with politicians are prioritizing prisons, policing, and other forms of state violence. There's a problem of poverty in all these communities, and other problems. And instead of sort of looking at how to create better jobs, create better healthcare and education systems, we're seeing the collusion between the private sector and the politicians to create policies to increase policing, increase surveillance, increase more prisons. Increase new forms of prison. So even if they're not housing people inside a prison, they can find them whenever if they have an electronic monitor on them. And I think the overall arch is the criminalization of people of color and immigrants. Mm-hmm. And going after them, blaming these communities for the poverty, blaming these communities for the economic problems of the country. And justifying, getting that to justify their killings by the cops, to justify their incarceration, and we're going to be bringing groups that are working on all these issues this weekend here in Florida.
Where can folks go to find out more information about these protests and about further actions moving forward?
You can find information on our website, enlaceintl.org.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Carrillo, the executive director of Enlace. Enlace, the group out of Portland, working on a divestment campaign. That's divesting from prisons, from private prisons. They're in Florida doing an action tomorrow. Again, you can go to enlaceintl.org for more information. Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That was KBOO's Jared Dantzler with Daniel Garrillo from Enlace.
Over 4,600 people have been confirmed dead in the earthquake that hit Nepal on Saturday. The disaster has shattered the nation's infrastructure as families and aid workers try to rebuild and stay safe from aftershocks. To learn more about the situation, we spoke with Mary Deshin, an anthropologist at Washington University in St. Louis. She also co-founded an academic journal on Nepali history and society. KBOO's Alan Monticello asked her about the relief effort, rural communities, and the role of international aid agencies in Nepal.
So everybody's living outside. There's almost no power. There's almost no water. And there's very little place to cook, and there's no organized food supply. So in 3 days, people are getting pretty desperate.
How have these sort of rural communities and the villages outside of that area, what resources do those communities have to help rebuild?
Right. Well, the epicenter was actually about 50 miles northwest of the Kathmandu Valley, and it's getting all the attention because of the large population there and the urban infrastructure and some accessibility. So there's pictures and so on. There's very little known so far about how much damage there's been up in the hills. What is known is that it's huge. The epicenter was a town called Barpak, which is very similar to a town west of there that I lived in for several years. It's a gurung. The people who live there are mainly gurung. People have all the skills to rebuild. They have the local materials to rebuild. They don't have the labor or the finances to do it. So they're subsistence farmers, and there's a huge amount of out-migration to the Gulf and to Malaysia and to Korea. So a lot of the young working age population are out of these villages. And there's already a huge manpower issue just for agriculture. So the local materials are there to rebuild. And they're going to need a lot of labor help, and they're going to need financial help. But again, we'd hope that that their skills get used to do really even better, sustainable, and appropriate technology rebuilding.
In a statement you released today, you also critiqued international relief and aid agencies for contributing to, I think, what you called some of the worst kinds of unsustainable development. Could you describe the role that they've played in contributing to or exacerbating some of the issues that have been facing Nepal?
Well, this is a very complicated issue, and I want to just say at the outset that right now, in this situation of such a big natural disaster, international aid is really essential. There's a lot of skill out there, and some very skilled people are coming in. Russia, China, India, the United States, Japan, and probably by now other countries have brought in really well-trained search and rescue teams, and those are critical. Nepal doesn't have that capacity. But I also want to say that Nepal has a huge amount of capacity for rebuilding itself in perhaps better ways, certainly in better ways than what's been happening over the last 20, 30 years under the aid regime. Nepal's national budget, take the health sector, for example, 50% of the budget is foreign aid, and that's true in education and a lot of other areas. And what that means is that that the aid agencies can dictate domestic policy. So these are things that you'll be familiar with, and many people will be familiar with, happening all over Latin America and in Africa and so on. And that dynamic has been very, very destructive in Nepal. And so, like, the kind of building that has occurred in the Kathmandu Valley, where there's been huge population increase. People are migrating in because there's not work elsewhere in the country. You get this very unbalanced so-called development going on, unplanned building, poor building, increases in economic inequality, great increases. There's a small middle class, and other people are becoming more and more impoverished. And turning to industrialization of agriculture, Monsanto coming in through USAID. These are all things that people in the country are struggling with prior to this. There are very big power projects, hydropower projects going on some of the main rivers in Nepal. We have yet to find out what has happened to those. That's not power that's going to necessarily do much for Nepal. It's going to get sold out of the country and have huge environmental effects.
That was Mary Desheen, an anthropologist at Washington University in St. Louis. Desheen and others have also called on the IMF and World Bank to cancel the $54 million in debt currently owed by the government of Nepal.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings. You are listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. As listeners surely already know, Portland is fast becoming an unaffordable place for many of us to live. The latest attempt to do something about it is called the Portland Renters Assembly, which the organizers define as a gathering of people united by the burden of rent. I'm excited that renters are getting themselves organized, but as with so many examples of emergency response activism, I'm skeptical that their current work will bear fruit unless they identify and then directly confront the institutional causes of this problem. As they state in their public documents, there's a need to stand behind those facing foreclosure, eviction, renoviction, houselessness, and rents rising well beyond livability. The assemblies discuss the collective strategies
to fight back against the exploitation of the human need for housing. I couldn't agree more, but how we stand with each other as disenfranchised people and what collective strategies we choose to explore are a very important issue to figure out if we don't wish to waste everybody's time. I'd like to take a crack right now at reframing what the problem is. Here goes. Fact number one. A large percentage of Portland residents are tenants with very few legal rights protecting us from eviction or substantial hikes in our rent. A very, very small number of people and corporations, some local but many not, own all of the rental housing in Portland. Questions we need to discuss among ourselves regarding fact number one. Why do we, the majority of Portland residents, continue to allow a small number of individuals and corporations to own so much real estate here in Portland? And what are the structures of law that make this disparity virtually inevitable? Fact number two. Home and apartment rental owners have vastly more constitutionally protected rights than do non-property owners. Namely, they have property rights. In other words, those with property are protected by our current U.S. Constitution, while those who do not own property have no relevant constitutional rights. In our country and in our current U.S. Constitution, property rights trump all other rights. Questions we need to discuss regarding fact number two. Why do we, the majority of Portland residents, continue to allow property rights to trump all other rights? Why do we allow corporate owners of property to possess any constitutional rights at all when we know that it's ridiculous that corporations are allowed to exercise constitutional rights? Is it conceivable that we cannot get our rights as tenants fully recognized and enforced until we also tackle these historical realities? Can we begin to imagine what a new set of local and state laws might look like, where renters and owners would enjoy fully equal rights under law? Fact number three, it is currently illegal in the state of Oregon and many other states for local governments to pass rent control laws. Questions we need to ask regarding fact number three. Why do we, the majority of Portland residents, continue to allow the state of Oregon to preempt and thus violate our inherent right of self-government as enshrined by our state constitution, which states, quote, that all power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their peace, safety, and happiness, and they have at all times a right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in such manner as they may think proper, unquote. If all power is indeed inherent in the people, why are we not exercising this power? Imagine instead we, the majority of Portland residents, working together in solidarity to envision a series of Portland ballot initiatives that take back our inherent right of self-government. Specifically, these ballot initiatives could prohibit no-cause evictions. They could strip property owners of any superior rights to those rights held by non-property-owning residents. They could prohibit banks from foreclosing on homeowners who have fallen behind on their mortgages. They could guarantee to all Portland residents the right to have a roof over their heads. These are the sorts of ordinances that we could pass locally by using the strategic framework of the community rights model of local enforceable lawmaking. When our state government tells us that we are prohibited from protecting the health and welfare of local renters, the government's position is illegitimate. When governments deny rights to people, those governments themselves become illegitimate, and it's then our responsibility as citizens to alter, reform, or abolish our government in such manner as we may think proper. These are our inherent rights as we, the people of Oregon, and it's about time we started to use them. Yes, it's true, we barely know what these words mean anymore, so we've got a lot of community education that we're going to have to do together. But quite frankly, we have no time to waste. The situation is urgent. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
And you are listening to the KBOO, Tuesday KBOO Evening News. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America Oregon, presenting a symposium on diversity, equity, and economic sustainability, May 8th at the Chiles Center. Keynote speaker is Stedman Graham. Tickets and information at volunteersofamericaoregon.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:45 for a special report on the Portland School Board elections. KBOO reporters Joe Meyer and Don Merrill have interviewed all 11 candidates. These will be aired every day this week at 5:45 p.m. At 6, it's time to tune in, turn on, and remember 45 years of KBOO memories hosted by Dan Johnson and Jenka Soderberg. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight, a chance of rain, showers, and or drizzle with a low around 45. Tomorrow, a chance of drizzle, rain, showers with a high near 61. Today in history, in 1789, the mutiny on the Bounty, rebelling crew members led by Minister Christian set the captain, William Bligh, and 18 others adrift in the South Pacific. In 1952, war with Japan officially ended and Dwight D. Eisenhower, the general, resigned as Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. And in 1967, boxing champion Muhammad Ali refused to be inducted into the army. Ali famously said, "The word Islam means peace. The word Muslim means one who surrenders to God. But the press makes us seem like haters."
Unions representing workers at KGW-TV held a rally at Pioneer Square on Saturday, shining a spotlight on the radical changes their parent company, Tegna, wants to make to their contracts. Those changes could range from the loss of union jobs to the end of a local presence at Portland's NBC affiliate station, KGW. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
It was a beautiful Saturday morning, and blues man Norman Sylvester and his band could be heard for blocks.
Do you need a piece of the action?
No!
For the union workers?
No!
Somebody say yes! Yeah.
But it wasn't a party, it was a rally. And he wasn't playing for fun, he was fighting for a cause. Sylvester was at Pioneer Square with about 300 of his union brothers and sisters. He was performing at the request of the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and the Screen Actors Guild American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. These three unions represent workers at Portland television station KGW.
I work 8 hours a day.
The station and the unions are locked in a battle over the future of jobs and of the station.
Rosetta Menger, I'm the president of IOTC Local 28. We are the Portland local stagehand and wardrobe union.
She was one of many union reps on hand at the Pioneer Square rally to support KGW's workers.
We know that there are already anti-union initiatives being dropped in Salem that are going to be on our next ballot.
Among them, two right-to-work measures that Washington County Attorney Jill Gibson is trying to get introduced for voters in 2016.
And these have caused very anti-union, anti-labor legislation being passed in other states across the country. And we hope that Oregon will not fall to that.
According to NorthwestLaborPress.com, KGW and Seattle's KING-TV are among two of 46 TV stations that owner Gannett is trying to overhaul.
Most people have language in their contracts that sort of describes who they are and what they do, and that those particular positions would be covered by a collective bargaining agreement.
Angela Marshall represents IBEW Local 46 in Seattle.
What they would like to do is change that and say, hey, we'll maybe recognize some of these, but we also can hire somebody off the street, and they don't necessarily need to be in the union.
In other words, Gannett wants the unions to agree to a change in their collective bargaining contracts that'll let the company hire non-union people to do jobs currently done by union workers. Donna Hammond represents IBEW Local 48, which includes the workers of KGW.
It's all about automation, making money for the corporate stakeholders, and we have a signal now that's being transmitted from Tampa, Florida. And so in case of an emergency, we don't have any local broadcasts from KGW.
This was something I heard from State Representative Lou Frederick, who also spoke at the rally. Mr. Frederick, a former KGW announcer and now representing District 43, told me one of the problems with this move toward automation was a loss of local coverage. And he used the example of the train derailment in Minot, North Dakota back in 2002. At 2:30 in the morning, 30 cars of a Canadian Pacific train derailed about 4 miles west of the city. Tanker cars carrying ammonia ruptured and released a cloud of poisonous gas. As local stations were running in automated mode, there was nobody on site to interrupt programming and issue warnings concerning the disaster. Dave Trudell is a union rep representing IASTE, Local 600.
This community cannot afford to lose this asset, and it's not an asset that belongs to Tegna or Gannett or Carl Icahn. It belongs to all of us by law. It is our air. It's not their air.
I asked Ms. Manger, IASTE Local 28 president, what Portlanders can do.
Call your congressmen, your senators. Right now we've got a big campaign going to call Senator Wyden, ask him to please stop the fast track. It's going up for vote. The fast track TPP. Another thing, a lot of money from the 1% fighting against labor. They're trying to get that passed. It's going to be bad for all of us. They've been working on it behind closed doors for the last 5 years. It's going to hurt all of us if that passes.
And blues man Norman Sylvester gets the last word.
A lot of men and women marched and marched and marched and died to get these unions to where they were, you know, and it was union families, the union. But now it's going the other way, and it's a sad situation. So that's why I'm here today, to try to, whatever I can do, that little small piece, it helps.
At Pioneer Square in downtown Portland, I'm Don Merrill, Cable News.
More than 1,000 protesters gathered outside the Supreme Court building today as justices heard oral arguments on the legality of same-sex marriage. One protester got inside the court and interrupted the proceedings early on.
General, would you like to take a moment?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Laws banning same-sex marriage in Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee had been challenged and upheld in a lower court. The Supreme Court accepted the appeals of those cases and bundled the four into one for today's hearing. The Supreme Court judges will decide two questions. First, does the Constitution require states to allow people of the same sex to marry? Second, should states that ban same-sex marriage honor a same-sex marriage performed in different states? Tennessee Solicitor General Joseph Whalen, arguing against marriage equality, had a hard time defending his position before the justices.
The 14th Amendment does not require states with traditional marriage laws to recognize marriages from other states between two persons of the same sex. Your Honor, this court's cases have made clear that the court draws a distinction between judgments between states and the laws of each state. And the reason, in part, that the court's decisions have said that is that otherwise, each state would be able to essentially legislate for every other state.
So there's nothing in the Constitution that requires a state to acknowledge even those marriages in other states that are the same.
That's essentially correct, Your Honor.
Really?
Under this court's decisions, that's essentially right.
New York can say the only marriages we acknowledge in New York are those marriages that have been made under the laws of New York.
Yes, Your Honor.
Really? What case would you cite to support that proposition?
I'm not sure if I understood the question correctly, Your Honor.
What is the case that holds that the state of New York has the right to recognize only marriages made in New York? And when, if you're married in Virginia, New York has the constitutional right to say we treat you as if you weren't married, whoever you are.
I did misunderstand the question. My understanding of the question was whether New York could decline to recognize an out-of-state marriage that did not comport with New York's law.
That's not what I said.
Because it is clear that if the law of the two states is the same, that was used against Fetter. And the state cannot say, we won't apply the other state's law, even though it's the same as our own.
Even though it's the same as ours?
Yes.
Right, like New York, for example, I happen to know, has a law that a federal judge from Washington couldn't marry someone. I mean, you can get married to your own wife, but et cetera, but you can't marry two other people. But the District of Columbia has the opposite law. So if I marry two people in Washington, D.C., and they happen to move to New York, you're saying that New York doesn't have to recognize that marriage because it doesn't comport with the marriage of New York. Is that your point?
I think that's...
And then what case says that? I think there are a few people going to get nervous about this.
The court is expected to hand down its ruling this June.
Today's Supreme Court hearing on marriage equality brings out another potential question on this issue. Can people have their wedding cake and eat it too? Here in Oregon, a bakery is being fined for discrimination because they refused to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Sweet Cakes by Melissa started a GoFundMe campaign, raising over $100,000 to pay their fines. GoFundMe canceled the fundraiser, citing a violation of their terms and conditions. The campaign to support Sweet Cakes by Melissa was found to be in violation of Oregon state law. Aaron and Melissa Klein responded on their Facebook page with a statement implying that, quote, Satan, unquote, was behind the decision by GoFundMe to shut down their page. Supporters of marriage equality then filled their Facebook page with pleas for the now-shuttered baking company to focus their donations on people and places in need here in the U.S. and in devastated Nepal.
Genetically engineered mosquitoes may soon be released in the Florida Keys. The British biotech firm Oxitec is creating mosquitoes with lethal genes that break their reproductive cycles. The mosquito's offspring will die before reaching maturity. This effort is being promoted by the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District. They say these genetically engineered mosquitoes will boost tourism in the Keys by reducing dengue fever, even though the Keys haven't had a case in 5 years. Public opposition defeated Oxitec's first plan to release these mosquitoes in Key West back in 2012.
A recent report in Nature, the weekly journal of science, found another problem with bees and neonicotinoid pesticides. Apparently, bees who ingest the nicotine-related pesticide end up somehow addicted to it. Researchers at the Newcastle University in the UK performed similar experiments in the lab, offering bees a choice between pure sugar water or a solution containing low doses of neonicotinoids. They discovered that honeybees drank more from sugar solutions containing the pesticide. The Nature report suggests that the bees don't taste the added chemicals and thus cannot control their exposure to neonicotinoids. Numerous studies in the past have linked the increased use of neonicotinoid pesticides to the decline in bee populations. The pesticides have been found to affect the neural system in bees, in addition to damaging their immune system. One of the Newcastle University researchers said that the most likely reason for the bees' preference for pesticide-containing sugar water is the similarity of the chemicals to nicotine.
And now, the latest in developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, April 28, 2015. Late on Monday night, a Palestinian worker died when a tunnel collapsed in Rafah City, southern Gaza Strip. The worker was identified as Muhammad al-Najjar, 27. His body was taken to Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital. Also in Gaza, as part of the daily violations against the Palestinian people in the besieged and impoverished Gaza Strip, Israeli Navy ships opened fire on a number of fishing boats in the Sudanese Area Sea, northwest of Gaza City. Local news sources reported that soldiers fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition on the fishing boats less than 4 nautical miles away from the Gaza shore. At least one boat was damaged, while the fishers had to jump to the water to avoid Israeli Navy fire. In the West Bank, a child was moderately injured in Yatta town near the southern West Bank city of Hebron after being hit by an Israeli settler's car. Shehda Al-Amur, 5 years of age, was struck in Khilit Al-Maya area in Yatta town, south of Hebron, local sources said. Elsewhere, Israeli forces demolished Tuesday morning a Palestinian-owned home in the village of Hanabi Saleh, central West Bank. According to local sources, the home, built prior to Israel's 1967 occupation of the West Bank, was owned by Mohammed Mahmoud Tamimi, an American-Palestinian who lives abroad. Last month, Israel's civil administration issued a demolition order for Tamimi home, in addition to another 12 privately owned Palestinian homes in Hanabi Saleh. The Popular Committee of Hanabi Saleh has invited Israeli and international activists to join them to begin rebuilding the demolished home. Earlier on Tuesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 4 young Palestinian men in occupied East Jerusalem. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was a Tuesday, April 28, 2015, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Doug McVeigh, Alan Monticello, Cliff Verla, Jared Dantzler, and Jim Thompson. Special thanks to Don Merrill. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
I'm Jared Dantzler. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Rowland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio with the May Day topic. Let's talk about police unions. This May Day is also the 15th anniversary of the 2000 Portland May Day police riot. At 9, on Political Perspectives, we hear The Ecology of a Police State, a panel from the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference, which explores the intersections between the epidemic of mass incarceration and the environmental degradation which occurs, directly and indirectly, as a result of it. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Her guest is activist David Cobb, National Projects Director of Democracy Unlimited. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on the Radio Zine, host Gene Bradley speaks with Dr. Thor Hansen about his new book, The Triumph of Seeds, how grains, nuts, kernels, pulses, and pips conquered the plant kingdom and shaped human history. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned for KBOO In Depth, a report on Portland school board elections.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland Public School Board elections are May 19th. KBOO reporters Joe Meyer and Don Merrill have interviewed all 11 candidates using questions from you, the community. These will be aired on KBOO at 5:45 this week from Monday through Thursday. Here are Portland Public School Board Zone 2 candidates, Gretchen Hollins, Wes Soderbeck, Ann Constam, and Bobby Regan.
What's your question?
This is Hyung Nam. I'm a Portland Public Schools teacher. What do you think is the purpose of education?
I'm Paul Anthony, and I'm running for the Portland Public School Board, Zone 2. Education is intended to form good citizens, first and foremost of all. That means that they are capable and prepared to serve in the community, to live productive lives, to be happy in what they choose to do in their careers, happy with their families, prepared to make good choices. That's what we should see from education.
My name is Emma Russick-Williams, and I am running for Zone 2 director. The purpose of education is multifaceted. There are huge benefits to the community as well as to the individual for having an education, for being well-rounded.